topic of our lecture is, would George Washington have fought for the Confederacy or something similar? Since our first president did not live into the 19th century, the question itself is a moot one, and any answer is of necessity speculative. Nonetheless, it is a fact that both sides in the war between the states invoked the name of Washington, and both sides claimed him as their own. One historian has noted, quote, "Far and away the most often invoked icon of the Revolutionary period was George Washington. Throughout the antebellum period, he was beloved by Northerners and Southerners alike, and by 1861 had come to symbolize all that was virtuous and heroic about the American Revolution. In what has become one of the most famous speeches in American history, Abraham Lincoln's Cooper Union Address in 1860 asserted that, quote, could Washington himself speak, would he cast the blame of sectionalism upon us who sustain his policy, or upon you who repudiate it? We respect the warning of Washington, and we commend it to you, together with his example pointing to the right application of it." Noting Washington's strong commitment to the Union, Lincoln criticized those who made, quote, "invocations to Washington, imploring men to unsay what Washington said and undo what Washington did." It may seem self-evident, though, that as a Virginian, Washington would have drawn his sword to defend Mount Vernon and his neighbors and friends. The Confederate government put the equestrian statue of Washington that is next to the Capitol building in Richmond on the gray seal of the Confederacy, and many politicians hearkened back to the early days of the Republic in their secession speeches. Jefferson Davis was sworn in as the permanent president of the Confederacy on Washington's birthday in 1861, and that was no accident. In his inaugural address, Davis said, "On this birthday of the man most identified with the establishment of American independence, and beneath the monument erected to commemorate his heroic virtues and those of his compatriots, we have assembled to usher into existence the permanent government of the Confederate States. We will perpetuate principles of our revolutionary fathers. The day, the memory, and the purpose seem fitly associated. We are in arms to renew such sacrifices as our fathers made to the holy cause of constitutional liberty." The common soldiers of the Confederacy referred to Washington in their letters home from the battlefield. Both Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis were sometimes called the Second Washington. But don't be hasty in claiming the father of our country as a Confederate. In October 2004, in American History magazine, William F. B. Vaudrey wrote an article entitled, "George Washington, Hero of the Confederacy?" Vaudrey is a Christian historian from Ohio who was past president of the Cleveland Civil War Roundtable. In that essay, he argued that Washington would have voted for Abraham Lincoln and, in fact, would have moved to the North to get out of the Confederacy. I see some of you already making fun of Mr. Vaudrey. He builds his case on the actual words of George Washington, however, so don't be hasty. While this question about the father of the country has not engaged us, like what would have happened if the Confederates had won at Gettysburg? I mean, that's the number one most speculative question of the war. We'll leave that one to Newt Gingrich and Harry Turtledove and McKinley Cantor, who all wrote novels based on the South winning at Gettysburg. Or what would have happened if Lincoln had not been assassinated? That's another mind game that people like to play with history. The loyalties of Washington ought to at least provoke some interesting debate. Now, again, this being a history lecture is, in the end, at the bottom, just speculation and sort of an enjoyable exercise. But it's one that deals with various principles that I think you'll find useful. Washington was firmly, indeed unshakably, for the Union. On June the 8th, 1783, just 2 years after his triumph at Yorktown, Washington sent this message to the state governors, urging them to downplay local jealousies in order to strengthen the Union. He said this, "It is indispensable to the happiness of the individual states that there should be lodged somewhere a supreme power to regulate and govern the general concerns of the Republic, without which the Union cannot be of long duration. That there must be a faithful and pointed compliance on the part of every state with the proposals and demands of the Congress, or the most fatal consequences will ensue. That whatever measures have a tendency to dissolve the Union or contribute to violate or lessen the sovereign authority ought to be considered as hostile to the liberty and independency of America, and the authors of them treated accordingly. Without an entire conformity to the spirit of the Union, we cannot exist as an independent power." 3 years later, Washington wrote to future Chief Justice of the United States, John Jay, "I do not conceive we can exist long as a nation without having lodged somewhere a power which will pervade the whole Union in as energetic a manner as the authority of the state governments extend over the several states." In 1786, the inhabitants of western Massachusetts took up arms against monetary policies imposed by their own elected government. Historian Edmund Morgan wrote that Washington, quote, "was outraged by the very idea of rebellion against a Republican government. In the years that followed the winning of independence, as the power of Congress continued to wane, his great worry had been that the failure of the states to support the Union would destroy our national character and render us as contemptible in the eyes of Europe as we have it in our power to be respectable." And then after the Constitutional Convention had adjourned, he wrote in 1787, "There are characters who prefer disunion or separate confederacies to the general government which is offered to them. But as nothing in my conception is more to be deprecated than disunion or the separate confederacies, my voice, as far as it will extend, shall be offered in favor of the Union." And I could add more quotes to that. Mr. Vaudrey opines that Washington would have condemned the Confederacy in the very loudest terms. Washington said in a letter to historian and educator Reverend William Gordon, "When the band of union gets once broken, everything ruinous to our future prospects is to be apprehended. The best that can come of it, in my humble opinion, is that we shall sink into obscurity, unless our civil broils should keep us in remembrance and fill the page of history with the direful consequences of them." And he goes on to say that Washington held none of the views that Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and others held. And then concludes by saying, "Had he lived to see it, Washington would not have supported the Confederacy. His principles were timeless. His commitment to the Union absolute. His opposition to slavery had grown strong, and his personality was such that he surely would never have been swayed by the secessionist hysteria of the early 1860s. No one worked harder or did more than George Washington to see that the United States would become and remain one nation, indivisible." Well, he receives reinforcements from Pulitzer Prize-winning historians, contemporary historians. Joseph Ellis wrote, "The reincarnated Washington would have gone with Lincoln in the Union in 1861. If you want to quote Joseph Ellis, famous plagiarizer, got caught. But it's a great historian, just writes best-selling books one after the other. And then, of course, that renowned conservative Gary Wills, who wrote, "He was as ardent a proponent of union as Lincoln was." Okay, well, the arguments put forth by William Vaudrey are based on several presuppositions. One is that the Union in 1860 was substantially the same as that in 1790. Another is that the Republican Party stood for union, and that it was the only one that did. He also seems to think that secessionists were not interested in upholding the Constitution. Finally, Mr. Vaudrey sees Washington as a proto-abolitionist. To confirm his thesis, he quotes Washington's statements on the nature of the Union and quotes recent Pulitzer Prize historians that Washington would have loved Abraham Lincoln because of his views on the Union and, of course, would have voted for him. And I just want to test this thesis a little bit today. I would suggest to you that the Union of 1860 was very different from the Union of 1790. 70 years had elapsed, and the Constitution, so beloved by George Washington, had undergone stresses and strains. Some had been brought about by the principles of judicial review, inaugurated by Justice John Marshall after the death of Washington. The Republic remained intact, though, and had weathered every storm thus far, just as Washington had hoped. Political compromise had worked, although viewing things from our vantage point, we are wont to say the compromise is just postponed, the ultimate showdown. Although he was aware of the disagreements among his own cabinet members, especially Jefferson and Hamilton, his hope was that the party strife on a large scale, could be avoided. Americans would have none of it, though. Two competing political theories that were in their infancy in 1790 were illustrated in bold relief on a number of occasions over the next 70 years. There were those who believed in a strong central government and were quite willing to use that power. They also tended to take a loose construction of the Constitution. Now, by loose construction, I mean that they took a broad view of the meaning and tended to interpret it according to present cultural or political conditions. The majority of the Supreme Court justices over the last 50 years have taken that idea to new levels of redefinition of the language and meaning of the Constitution. One of the first to move in that direction was Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton never really got over the monarchy of Great Britain. Washington realized the differences between Hamilton and Jefferson, but was able to use them effectively, even as he warned of party spirit damaging the country. As soon as he was out of office, however, the warnings of Washington were ignored, and the battle was on for the soul of the United States. Now, we're so used to that idea today that the Constitution is a living, breathing document that changes with every generation and every wind of political blowing, and that's what's taught in all of the law schools, almost all of the law schools in our nation. That's what lawyers, when they actually do take a course on the Constitution, are taught, that you can make it mean whatever you want it to mean. In the War of 1812, men of Federalist conviction in New England continued trade with Britain and protested the war by withholding troops and supplies, and finally meeting in Hartford, Connecticut, to discuss secession. Just as Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts and the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania, it wasn't the South Washington had to worry about damaging the Republic. Had he been there in 1814, he would have sighed, "Here we go again," and the break with the Constitution would once again have been a northern problem. No one respected the founders and the founding documents more than the Calhoun faction that dominated Congress from the 1820s to the 1840s and developed what today is called the strict construction of the Constitution. That is, the founders intended us to read the words and act according to their actual meaning rather than make them pliable to fit the times. Now, Washington would have understood the impetus of Americans moving westward and the philosophy of manifest destiny. After all, he himself had been a land speculator and even frontiered and even surveyed frontier lands. Manifest destiny, the idea that the Americans were destined by providence to bring under their jurisdiction all of the land of North America. Washington, I think, would have understood that instinctively, that eventually that is what would take place. The event that brought it all to a head was the question of Texas statehood. Washington may not have appreciated so much the attempts to prevent the southern states from expanding westward also. And when Texas statehood was broached in Congress a number of particularly Northeastern congressmen, but others as well, dug in their heels and said, we are not going to bring Texas into the Union because it will create another southern state. And they already have too much power, even though the northern states by that time had become much more populous and had a much larger presence in the Congress. It took another Virginia president, John Tyler, actually, to bring Texas into the fold. It was the last state to permit slavery and the last of the southern states to enter the Union. Washington perhaps would not have understood the attempt of Henry Clay to implement what he called the American system of increasing tariffs to protect New England manufacturers and raise revenues for what were called internal improvements. In a bold move to build roads and bridges in Kentucky and elsewhere with federal tax money, while the price of imported commodities were raised for the consumers, especially in the areas that provided raw materials, that is the South, Clay sought to increase federal power over the states through the Whig Party. And he called that his American system. Well, Southerners took a very dim view of that, in particular John C. Calhoun, at the time Vice President of the United States. And South Carolina took such a dim view of it that they nullified that federal tariff known as the Tariff of Abominations. Now, there was a great deal. This is a very complex issue, and it runs like a thread all through the 19th century up until the war between the states, the struggle between those who wanted to raise larger government revenues by increasing the taxes on imports. Now, the federal government, according to the Constitution, could only raise money in two ways. Or I should say practically they could in two ways, but constitutionally they could only raise it by tariffs, that is taxes on imports, or selling land. And Henry Clay wanted as much money as the federal government could get so that they could build what's today called infrastructure. Take the money from taxpayers in Florida and build roads and bridges in Kentucky. And that sort of thing. And it was opposed in general by Southerners as a violation of various constitutional principles, and it was debated in those terms. The nature of the Union was changing as Northern and Western political interests gained ground in the 1840s and 50s. After the war with Mexico, cracks in the ability of Congress to compromise began appearing with regularity. No longer were those cracks along party lines, Democrat versus Whig. But now those cracks emerged between slave states and non-slave states, between the states of the Union that wanted to expand westward but keep Southerners in their place and retain the slave states in the places where they were already found. Even George Washington would have been forced to reckon with the attempt to marginalize his home region and eliminate Virginia as a political factor in the decision-making process. He'd warned against party faction. In fact, it was one of the topics he liked to discourse on in order to maintain union. By mid-century, new parties with special agendas proliferated. There were the anti-Masons, and it's like anteaters. Their name tells you what they're about. The anti-Masons were a political party based on attacking the Masonic Lodge, which some people thought had way too much political influence in the government. And there were so many anti-Masons in New York State that it cost the Whigs an election. There were the Know-Nothings. Now, that wasn't their official name, I think. I can't remember what their official name was, probably something like the American Party. But if you asked them, you know, what they were doing, late at night, they would say, I know nothing. They were anti-Roman Catholic and anti-immigrant, and they did all in their power to keep immigrants from coming to the United States and to persecuting Roman Catholics. And then there were the Free Soilers. Now, this doesn't have reference to babies, of course. But it was the people who wanted to expand the free states westward and to block the southern states and southerners from creating new southern states. Now, according to the law, according to the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which many southerners thought was unconstitutional in and of itself, and it may very well have been, it later got canceled out by another act, drew a line, and it was you might think of it as the Mason and Dixon line, but it drew the line all the way across the country, a theoretical line, below which could be slave states and above which would be free states. And that particular line now came into play after the Mexican War, when the United States obtained the rest of the continent from Mexico. And the Northeastern political interests and some of the Midwesterners had a change of heart over allowing southern states to expand westward. And so the Whigs and the Democrats and then all the minor parties fought over who was going to be allowed to create new states. He would have recognized the Southern Democrats, for their political philosophy was similar to his still. But the rest were manifestations of reaction and discontent, the very things about which Washington was most opposed. With the combination of the malcontents into the Republican Party, dedicated to restricting possible territorial expansion of southern states, raising huge tariffs, and for some, getting rid of slavery by extraordinary measures, I think George Washington would not have recognized the Union of 1860. With the triumph of the Republicans in that year, I would contend that he would have reconsidered his position on the inviolability of the Union. And when the new government called for armies to invade Virginia, I think his love of Mount Vernon would have trumped his affection for Boston. The abolitionist parties in the North were calling for revolution. They were calling for slave uprisings in the South. They were calling for slaves to rise up and kill your masters if you have to, and flee to the hills. And that eventually actually took wing with the terrorist John Brown. I'll mention him in a moment. These are the kinds of things that George Washington would have abhorred and would have resisted with all of his fervor. If you look at the 1860 Republican platform, the election of 1860, you would see that there are a number of issues in there that were inimical to Virginia and to Southern interests, and it was argued inimical to American interests, for they could only lead not just to folly, but they could lead to a division of the country, which indeed, when the Republicans were elected, the seven deep South states left the Union. In that Republican platform were statements like this, that the present Democratic administration has far exceeded our worst apprehensions in its measureless subservience to the exactions of a sectional interest. That is, there were still lots of Southerners in the Democratic Party, which was a horrible thought, as especially evinced in a desperate exertions to force the infamous Lecompton Constitution upon the protesting people of Kansas. And that came from the Bleeding Kansas, where the people of Kansas and Nebraska were given the opportunity by Congress to choose whether they wanted to be slave or free, if they wanted to be southern states or northern state. And a lot of Southerners lived in Kansas. And the thought was that if there were enough people there that were sympathetic to the South, they would vote in a constitution that would allow for slavery. Now, Kansas was not destined to become a slave state in any event, and probably wouldn't have become a slave state under any circumstances. However, the reaction of the Northeast abolitionist parties and Free Soil Party, eventually Republican Party, was to send immigrants to Kansas by the thousands to make sure that they voted the right way. And just to ensure that they could do that, they were armed and equipped by churches who gave them repeating firearms, so in case they ran into a Southerner, they would know how to settle the issue. And Kansas broke out into this, and Missouri too, both broke out into this civil war that continued all the way until 1865, a true civil war in those states in the Midwest, because of the agitation between the northern and southern interests in that place. And in the Republican platform, they excoriate the Democratic Party for recognizing the Constitution that was passed in Kansas. The ones who were not sympathetic to the slaveholders didn't vote. And so those of Southern interests were able to install a Constitution, which was accepted by the Democratic Party. Republican Party said, no, you can't do that. It denies the vital principles of a free government. It's a contemplation of treason. People should sternly be rebuked and forever silent on this issue there. So the Republican Party was throwing down the gauntlet in front of the Democrats, but in particular the Southern Democratic Party and the South itself. And it goes on with a number of anti-Southern propositions, as well as a promotion of high tariffs, high taxes, in order for internal improvements to be made, particularly in the North. I don't know how many people realize that Abraham Lincoln was one of the lawyers of the new railroad that the party was promoting, the railroad they wanted to run through Illinois, as a matter of fact, and that they wanted federal money to build these railroads, the Transcontinental Railroad, to build it across Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and then to the free states of the Midwest, the new states that were being formulated after the Mexican War. So the Republican platform itself was inimical to Southern and Midwestern, to a large extent, interests. The election of 1860, Abraham Lincoln got slightly under 40% of the popular vote, but he won the election. He wasn't even on the ballot in the South. But the Republican Party won the election, proving that now the Republic had become a purely of sectional interest, that a handful of states, a handful of populous states, full of all of those hundreds of thousands of new immigrants, could carry an election. And to read about the election of 1860 and the manipulation and the calculations of how to now be elected, even though you were a small minority, are very interesting to see. But it would have been the kind of thing that Washington would have abhorred and would have opposed. Now, when secession finally came, the new Confederate government retained its respect for American history and the heroes of the nation. They modeled the Confederate Constitution after one of the founders, with modifications more reminiscent of the Articles of Confederation. I think Washington would have recognized this new document and, I think, appreciate the changes. One of the things the Confederate Constitution did was make the term of the president 1 6-year term, and he could not succeed himself. They saw what happened when a president got into office. He spent the next 4 years figuring out ways to get reelected for another term in office. And in our own day, that's taken on the form of giving stuff away and building a constituency utterly dependent upon the party in power in order to get reelected. And that's what the Confederates, the Southerners who wrote their Constitution, although it looks and feels like the U.S. Constitution, it closes some of the gaps that they saw that Patrick Henry had seen. They were able to sew up some of those holes, one of them being the president. They said a president should have 6 years to achieve his agenda, but after that, and he won't spend all his time figuring out ways to get reelected. They got rid of the Supreme Court. So the state Supreme Courts have always been adequate to our laws. And so the state Supreme Courts became the highest courts in the land, as they had been under the Articles of Confederation and as had actually practically worked out through the early part of the Republic. So they were they also, by the way, banned the slave trade. And there are a number of interesting aspects, and the Confederate Constitution in some ways I think is the apex of American constitutional thinking. It is not the most studied document today, however. And it did right a lot of the potential wrongs. They got rid of some of those clauses that those who believe in a loose construction have driven trucks through over the last 100 and some years. Well, Washington really became the iconic figure of the Confederacy. They even wanted to adopt the American flag. The Confederacy said, we have to have a flag. And some said, well, let's just keep the old one because we are the preservers of the old republic as the founders intended it. Others said, no, we can't do that. We're going to end up on the battlefield with these people. And we need a flag of our own. And eventually they went through several permutations of the creation of their own flag, but it was red, white, and blue. And it was stripes and stars. And the Constitution looked just like the U.S. Constitution with a few adjustments. Finally, on the issue of slavery, Mr. Vaudrey protesteth too much. It is true that George Washington kept his slaves and treated them well. It does seem he hoped for gradual emancipation. So did many other Southerners. In fact, many Southerners believed that there would be gradual emancipation. It had happened in all the other countries of Western Europe. And of all the countries, of all the nations of the 19th century that were slaveholding nations, only one fought a war to end slavery. All the rest were able to do it over time and without bloodshed. The operative word is gradual emancipation. Washington was no proto-abolitionist. He did not free his slaves until he was sure that Martha was well supplied with steady income after his death. The debate over gradual emancipation was sometimes freewheeling and widespread in the decades before 1820. In that year, however, the abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, was inaugurated in New York. A bloody slave uprising in Southampton County, Virginia, occurred, and vocal agitation for immediate manumission was preached from a few northern pulpits. Put on the defensive in perceiving agitation for slave revolution being advocated by radicals in the North, further debate in the South was stifled. Might add this, Republican Party was not an abolitionist party. The number of abolitionists in the North, those who, and by abolitionists I mean those who wanted to abolish slavery right now, without compensation, without pass and go, without collecting $200. Slavery has to be ended. And if not done so that way, it needs to be ended by revolution or slave uprisings, etc. Those are the abolitionists, and they represented a tiny, tiny minority of Northern voters. On top of that, the interest in most of the North was not the abolition of slavery immediately. Most people hoped that eventually it would be abolished, and it probably would have been over a gradual period of time. Many Southerners believed that and wanted that as well. Some did not. However, the question was, how do we live in peace and harmony politically and socially until that time can come? The abolitionists said, we cannot. They were not the major part of the Republican Party. Abraham Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He was very much not an abolitionist. He believed in free soil and free men. He believed that new states should be formed without allowing slavery. He was all for restricting slavery to the South. It is interesting that in 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by the administration, that about 6 northern states immediately passed laws prohibiting black people from coming across their borders into their states. They were all for free soil, but they were all for keeping all of the ex-slaves in the South where they belonged. So it's an interesting and complex issue, and it's one that we will address tomorrow morning in a DVD that we're going to look at and I'm going to comment on. But I said all that to say this, that George Washington was no proto-abolitionist. He understood that slavery had been affixed by their ancestors on America and was not going to go away instantly or anytime soon. And had he heard the bloodthirsty talk coming from radicals in the North, it would have bothered him too. John Brown in 1859 invaded Virginia and attempted a slave revolt financed by radicalized New England preachers and intellectuals who, as I said, were in the tiny minority. It would have appalled Washington and brought about vehement reprisal, as it did in that time. Even on the subject of secession, George Washington commented on that. One of the foremost biographers, perhaps the one that's most often quoted, biographers of George Washington, is James Thomas Flexner, who wrote a multi-volume biography of George Washington. And in the volume, George Washington and the New Nation, he says this, Washington's correspondents wrote him that there was serious talk of grouping the states into two or three separate nations, each unified of interest in interests. There was also talk of abandoning political experimentation by reverting to that well-tried form monarchy. But as he disproved of both these possibilities, Washington did not exclude them from his thoughts. He admitted that, quote, should efforts to strengthen the federal government seem on full and dispassionate examination impractical or unwise, wisdom might dictate accepting a different form to avoid, if possible, civil discord and other ills. So he left it open, the possibility that if discord and disharmony and war would result from keeping the government together, then there's the possibility of various divisions. Now, that seems to contradict some of his other statements of the Union, regarding the Union. But I think we need to remember that in 1790, George Washington's nation was teetering. It was precarious. It was brand new. The European states could pounce at any time and put an end to this experiment in liberty. The idea that the fledgling United States needed to survive could only be held in terms of a union that was indissoluble. Otherwise, it would fly apart and the Europeans would be there to pick up the pieces. The country was on the verge of bankruptcy in 1790, and George Washington saw all the implications of that. In 1860, the country was prosperous. It was growing. It was solid. It was one of the great nations among the nations. George Washington was convinced that the country would die if not unified in the nature that it was unified in his day. The Union of 1860 was different and could have sustained a division, even if it was just temporary. It could have sustained the leaving of seven Deep South states, who most likely would have been brought back in eventually. We have to not underestimate the effect of things like John Brown's raid, which really was the final tear in the fabric of the Union. There are other things that brought about secession. The division of the churches is a huge one. That's another topic. The debates over the nature of the Union, the debates over the expansion of slavery into the territories, all of those were parts and parcel of the causes of secession and were debated honestly in Congress and among the people. But I think the things that eventually tore it for the southern states, all those issues together, there's a new book out. You think, well, there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to writing books on the Civil War, because there are 500,000 of them. But last year, Thomas Fleming came out with a new book about why the South seceded. And his grand thesis is because Southerners hate Yankees. And that's the bottom line. They left the Union because they couldn't stand those people. That's not a brand new argument, but it's one that hasn't been raised in quite a while. Some of these other factors seem to have a little more agreement in these days. Well, with the increased rhetoric, revolutionary tactics against Southerners in Kansas in the 1850s, the bold initiatives to prevent Southern territorial expansion, the possibility of compromise slipped away after 1854. What George Washington would have thought about all that, we'll never know. He was a planter whose wealth and position was dependent on slave labor. He was a stickler for protocol and opposed revolutionary violence. His reaction to abolitionist rhetoric and the invasion of John Brown, I think, would have brought the severest reprisals. I think he could not have imagined what the United States would become by 1860. Perhaps it would have been totally unrecognizable to him as it had changed over the years. What he would have recognized, though, was his beloved Mount Vernon and the tranquility of Southern plantation life. I believe that had he been resurrected in 1860 and appraised of the overall situation, with blue armies on the banks of the Potomac crying for the blood of the sons of Virginia, Washington would have seen his duty and offered his sword in Richmond. And what of Robert E. Lee? Said, would he have joined Robert E. Lee as a secessionist? You know, Robert E. Lee modeled his life after George Washington. He married into the family, as a matter of fact. He revered and honored the life and the demeanor and the character of George Washington. In fact, there's a book on how Robert E. Lee modeled his life on Washington. It was as if he lived life in the shadow of Mount Vernon. Robert E. Lee opposed secession, as George Washington would have, but he would not draw his sword against his country, Virginia. And when his sword was asked for by the state of Virginia, this is how it went. The members of the convention took their seats again. President Janney remained standing, and a moment later addressed General Lee in full and rounded periods. Major General Lee, he said solemnly, in the name of the people of your native state, here represented, I bid you a cordial and heartfelt welcome to this hall in which we may almost yet hear the echo of the voices of the statesmen, the soldiers, and sages of bygone days who have borne your name and whose blood now flows in your veins. We met in the month of February last, charged with the solemn duty of protecting the rights, the honor, and the interests of the people of the Commonwealth. And by the way, Virginia did not vote for secession. When the first secession votes were held, Virginia said the election of Abraham Lincoln is not sufficient reason to break from the Union. And North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas said the same thing. The election of the Republican Party can be overcome in time. But what can't be overcome is that after the election, Abraham Lincoln called for an army to march to the South and shed the blood of Southerners, to start a civil war. And Lee and Virginia and Stonewall Jackson and their fellow border states voted again, and they left the Union. And this meeting took place just after Virginia's secession. Now, Virginia, having taken her position as far as the power of this convention extends, we stand animated by one impulse, governed by one desire and one determination, and that is that she shall be defended. And I think that resonated with General Lee, because that's why he was there. And I think Washington would have seen the same thing. When the necessity became apparent of having a leader for our forces, all hearts and all eyes, by the impulse of an instinct, which is a surer guide than reason itself, turned to the old county of Westmoreland. We knew how prolific she had been in other days of heroes and statesmen. We knew she had given birth to the father of his country, to Richard Henry Lee, to Monroe, and last but not least, to your own gallant father, and knew well by your own deeds that her productive power was not yet exhausted. Then they refers to Lee's service in Mexico. And then finally, sir, we have by this unanimous vote expressed our conviction that you are at this day among the living citizens of Virginia, first in war. And that's what Washington was called by General Lee's father, Light Horse Harry Lee, who said that Washington was first in war and first in the hearts of his countrymen. We pray, God, most fervently that you may so conduct the operations committed to your charge that it will soon be said of you that you are first in peace. And when that time comes, you will have earned the still prouder distinction of being first in the hearts of your countrymen. So there, the convention in Richmond was drawing the cords tight between Robert E. Lee and George Washington. I close with one more remark. When the father of his country made his last will and testament, he gave his swords to his nephews with an injunction that they should never be drawn from their scabbards, except in self-defense or in defense of the rights and liberties of their country, and that if drawn for the latter purpose, they should fall with them in their hands rather than relinquish them. Yesterday, your mother, Virginia, placed her sword in your hand upon the implied condition that we know you will keep to the letter and in spirit, that you will draw it only in her defense, and that you will fall with it in your hand rather than that the object for which it was placed there should fail. And so Robert E. Lee, who was always embarrassed on public occasions, and when he was praised like that, it made him nervous. He said slowly and distinctly, "Mr. President and gentlemen of the convention, profoundly impressed with the solemnity of the occasion, for which I must say I was not prepared, I accept the position assigned to me by your partiality. I would have much preferred had your choice fallen to an abler man. Trusting in Almighty God and approving conscience and the aid of my fellow citizens, I devote myself to the service of my native state, in whose behalf alone will I ever again draw my sword." And I think that George Washington would have concurred.